I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a look at two issues affecting Hoosiers that have been before the Indiana General Assembly. In the first half of the show, we'll talk about the proposed cigarette tax increase. In the second, we'll discuss changes in credits applied to homeowners who use solar power. My guests in the first discussion are Monique French of the American Lung Association's Raise It for Health campaign and Indiana Representative Ed Clear, a Republican from New Albany. In the second, my guests are Jesse Carabanda of the Hoosier Environmental Council and Mark Massel of the Indiana Energy Association. Please join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or reaching out on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be doing the show in a little different frame today. Instead of doing one continuous conversation, we're actually going to have two in-depth ones about a couple of legislative hot topics, the proposed cigarette tax and net metering in regard to solar power. My guests in the first discussion, which is going to be about the cigarette tax, are Monique French of the American Lung Association's Raise It for Health and Indiana Representative Ed Clear, who is a Republican from New Albany. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Monique, I'm going to start with you and ask you to make the case for increasing the cigarette tax.
Right. So the Raise It for Health campaign, which consists of many organizations across the state, 50 state, local, and national organizations, are coming together to really make an impact on Hoosier health. We know that we've been ranking on the bottom on so many different metrics in health, and we know one impact that we can do to really improve the health of Hoosiers is increase the cigarette tax. We know if we increase the cigarette tax at least by $1.50, we can have over 58,000 Hoosiers quit, 48,000 kids not even pick up the product. We can help about 10,000 or more smoking-related pregnancies over the course of 5 years be averted. We know that there's also some cost savings to that as well. As a state, we know that we spend a lot of money in healthcare costs as it relates to tobacco use. The Fairbanks Foundation just released a study last week saying that we spend close to $540 million in Medicaid costs attributed just to those who use tobacco. We know statewide is about over $3 billion attributed to healthcare costs for those who use tobacco products. So we know that the great thing about increasing cigarette tax is that it helps people quit. It prevents kids from not even starting the project. And then the bonus is the revenue that goes back to the state, which we hope to go fund health programs. And so we really understand, and it's been proven over time. The last time we raised the tax was in 2007. And what we saw was that when we nearly doubled the cigarette tax, we saw consumption reduced by 26%, and we saw increase of revenue by $155 million to the state budget. So that's are some of the points that we're really trying to hit out there, is that, you know, we're excited about the opportunity for the discussion to happen this session. But with that excitement, we need it to pass. We need to go ahead and stop kicking the can down the road and really invest in the health of Hoosiers. We work, live, and play in this great state, and so we really need to make sure that we invest in Hoosiers' lives, and that investment leads to healthier Hoosiers. Close to 11,000 Hoosiers die each year from tobacco-related diseases, and there have been some talk about, waiting to 2019, and for us, you know, that's just not an option right now, because by that time, 22,000 lives would have been lost to tobacco use. And we feel like this is a great time right now. It's been 10 years since we raised it last. Why not just go ahead and really invest in the health of Hoosiers?
Representative Clear, how did this play out within the legislative process?
Well, thanks, John, and, sure. and thanks for having me today. I think it's still playing out. Mm-hmm. It was in the House version of the budget at a dollar instead of $1.50. It came out of committee as $1.50. It was a dollar in the House budget, and it was removed from the Senate's budget. And I'm sure it will be a topic during the conference committee negotiations. I don't think the discussion is over yet. And it is an important discussion. I guess I'm in kind of an interesting position because I largely agree with Monique. And I think she raised some of the reasons that I have opposed the cigarette tax up to this point. First and foremost, that it's not being directed to funding health initiatives. And raising the cigarette tax a dollar is estimated to generate about $300 million in new annual revenue. And that opportunity, that kind of opportunity, doesn't come around very often. And I want to see us invest that in health. The United Health Foundation's America's Health Rankings report, the most recent report, had Indiana as one of the five worst states in the country when it comes to funding public health. And Monique mentioned the cost of tobacco-related illness. I think a $3 billion statewide estimate, and we have billions of dollars of additional costs related to other preventable illnesses. First and foremost, if we're going to raise the cigarette tax, we should be using the money to fund tobacco prevention and cessation, which has been dramatically underfunded in recent years. The CDC recommends that Indiana spend about $74 million a year on prevention and cessation. And I'd like to see us get to I think there was $35 million that was proposed earlier in the session, which would get us about halfway there. It would get us back to where we were some years ago. And then I think the elephant in the room is the opioid crisis and the need for funding addiction treatment. And here's an opportunity to do that. So I appreciate the argument. I'm largely with Monique and with the other advocates. It's just that I see this as a classic case of potentially winning the battle but losing the war, meaning the cigarette tax could be increased and we could see the immediate benefits, certainly at least some reduction in the number of people smoking, the number of children who start smoking, but lose the war in the sense of missing this this opportunity that may not come around again for quite a few years to invest significantly in public health.
And to attempt to, for our listeners to put in context, because there are a lot of moving parts to this discussion. As I understand it, and I am risking oversimplifying this greatly right now, the argument on the Senate side, one that the governor seems to have embraced as well, is that they would prefer to reserve a possible cigarette tax to pay for changes, possible changes in health care or really health insurance funding for the country if the Affordable Care Act is revisited. And I guess also just to synthesize here a little bit, Monique, the argument I heard is from you to some degree is, yes, that while the revenue would be nice, the real benefit for increasing taxes on cigarettes is that it creates a disincentive for people to smoke and damage their health. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And so increasing the cigarette tax, like I said, really helps Hoosiers quit. We know that individuals will stop using cigarette products, especially those who are price sensitive, which including our youth. And so we know that increasing the cigarette tax is one of the most effective policies that you can pass to see reduction in tobacco use. And to your point about
It's not my point. I'm trying to stay neutral
here in advance
with the argument.
And I understand. But what the argument is saying as far as waiting to 2019 to kind of see what the federal government is going to do, we just believe that we should not sacrifice Hoosiers' lives to wait to see what the federal government is going to do as it relates to Medicaid. This is something that we can do to save lives now. Over 4,000 kids become addicted to tobacco products every day. That's our nieces. That's our nephews. Those are our children in our community. That's our next future. So why miss this opportunity to really have a great impact on our next generation and those who are really suffering from this addiction, because tobacco is an addiction, but suffering from this addiction and giving them another tool to help them quit.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about, in the first half of this special No Limits, the proposed cigarette tax increase that is before the Indiana General Assembly right now. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what our regular listener Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. As you say, it's No Limits, so here we go. I've been a cigarette smoker for over 50 years, and the last 17 years I smoked a cigarette manufacturer that has absolutely no chemicals added. Every other cigarette in the United States has some combination by their research of 235 chemicals added to the tobacco. Many of those chemicals are known carcinogens. I smoke the same tobacco that my great-grandfather chewed until he was 92 years old before he finally died. There are many things out in this environment, and will be more so thanks to Mr. Trump, that are going to cause cancer and do cause cancer. My comment is, you know, I'm still fully employed. I have a farm. I stay busy. My cigarettes are one of the things that I do that I enjoy still. And please leave my cigarettes and me alone. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Monique, I'll give you a chance to respond, but also I'd like to hear Representative Clear's thoughts, because he comes from a part of the state that has historically been tobacco country.
Right. And so, you know, one thing that I think Ron pointed out is that, you know, tobacco impacts lung cancer. But one thing that we found with the Surgeon General's report a couple of years back is that tobacco products not only affect lung cancer, but they affect every part of the body, you know, anywhere from different types of cancers to diabetes. And so it's just not lung cancer as what our traditional said. We know that generally you'll be in a better health, a better state if you don't use tobacco products. And we know that at the end of the day, it is an addiction. If there's no additives in it, nicotine is still a component of tobacco. And so we do encourage you to quit, especially for a lot of other things such as secondhand smoke that can affect loved ones as well.
Representative Clear, as I mentioned, you come from a part of the state where, you know, tobacco is it mm-hmm. used to be Southern Indiana. We never thought of Indiana as a tobacco producing state, but it has that history. And obviously, I'm guessing that you have heard from some constituents who aren't thrilled with the idea of a cigarette tax.
Definitely. You know, I could go several different directions on this. I guess, we're next to Kentucky. New Albany is right across the Ohio River from Kentucky. I actually grew up next to a tobacco field. when the advocates present the map showing the higher cigarette tax in border states, the state that is always omitted from the map is Kentucky, and that's because Kentucky is the only border state that currently has a lower cigarette tax than Indiana. I believe their tax is 60 cents a pack right now. Ours is 99.5 cents. So there are some issues there. I've heard from constituents on that, and I don't mean to dismiss those concerns, but my my focus here is the use of these new dollars for health initiatives. You know, what I would say to Ron and other smokers is that if we're going to raise the tax on your cigarettes, we need to be very thoughtful about it and invest that money in ways that are going to to yield a return for taxpayers and Hoosiers at large, recognizing again the cost of preventable illness, including tobacco-related illness, and the fact that we have the opportunity here to do something about that. Again, I'm largely in agreement with Monique, but I also know that Monique and others, if the legislature passes a cigarette tax and doesn't spend the money on health, then in 2 years, all of these advocacy organizations are likely to be back at the State House asking for funding for initiatives that have been underfunded or not funded at all by the state for years. And, you know, the answer is likely to be the same. There's no money. And here we have money and we can fund these important initiatives. And we may not have that opportunity again in the near future.
And I know we've got calls that I do want to get to here, but I want to follow up on this. So do you think there would be a will in the legislature to adopt this tax, this increased tax, if it were in simply a dedicated fund that could be spent only on health and health care questions?
Yeah. Well, I haven't been in the Senate discussions, obviously, but my impression from the coverage I've read and what I've heard is that it would change the discussion over there based on statements that that Senator Kinley and Senator Long and others have made. I think the
Is it too late in the process to do that?
No, it's not. It's not too late in the process. And there was an amendment that was offered in the House at one point that that I supported that that would have put the cigarette tax revenue, I believe, in the HIP trust fund. And you know, something like that might be an intermediary step here, since we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level. We know something is probably going to happen. There are probably going to be changes. And I agree with Monique, we shouldn't necessarily just wait and see for 2 years, but we also shouldn't rush to pass this increase and spend the money elsewhere and then not have it available if we do need it. And let me mention real quick, John, and some of the callers may want to get to this, but I think there's a larger discussion to be had here. You know, we have a bill from the Senate, Senate Bill 1, dealing with vaping, and there's no provision in that vaping bill to tax e-cigarettes or vaping liquid. And I know there are folks in the State House who would like to talk about the alcohol tax. So I think there are some who would argue that we're also not having a full discussion about these issues.
Monique, real quickly, because I do want to get to these callers, would tax increase, I mean, if your focus is much more on creating the disincentive, having those funds dedicated, put in a dedicated fund that would go to like the HIP Trust Fund or something like that. Would that be acceptable?
Oh, yes.
Advocates for this?
Yeah, we will definitely support it. I mean, I think one of the things that we talked about within our campaign is that we would like to see $35 million go back to tobacco prevention cessation, where it was originally funded at 2001. And so we also know we have support. We've polled and showed that 70% of Hoosiers across the state support increasing the cigarette tax significantly at $1.50 and making sure that those funds are dedicated into that fund, such as tobacco prevention cessation and other health care initiatives such as HIP 2.0. So we would be in agreement with that.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the proposed cigarette tax before the Indiana General Assembly. David, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Mr. Crawl. It's a pleasure to be on your program again.
Thank you. And it's John, please. It's John. If you're a listener, it's John.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, the two folks that are talking, they're kind of touching the two issues that I wanted to ask about anyway. One would be the idea that that money, if we're going to raise the cigarette tax, it should simply go back to something having to do with cigarette tax, not to roads, not to alcohol, not to anything else, because that's why we're raising the tax. And then there's a part of me that wants to pose the question, okay, we see, I think Monique noted that we saw a $156 million bump in taxes and revenue from the taxes on cigarettes. Now, while we know that it does help, the relationship between those two things seems a bit odd, and maybe there ought to be a different way of looking at how we get people to stop smoking. I smoked for about 30 years. I quit about 15 years ago. at the behest of my kids and at the behest of the tax. So I can't argue against the tax, but I also know that as long as we're collecting that kind of money, we're going to have a legislature who is going to want to take that money and use it for something else. There will not be a point where you will be able to get a consensus of people who will be willing to take that money, all of it, and use it for getting people to stop smoking, unless we can find some fail-safe way of doing it. Your thoughts on that kind of idea?
Thank you very much for the call and for the question. Representative Clear, I'm going to throw that in. David, if I might, I'm going to take the liberty of reframing it ever so slightly. We do worry about this a little bit in that suppose the tax does work as a disincentive. People stop smoking. The revenues then, in theory, because if they're buying fewer cigarettes that come from that tax, I mean, is there concern that this really should not be something, a revenue stream that we should count on?
Well, yeah, John, I think if especially when we're talking about the need for sustainable funding for long-term needs such as road construction and maintenance, if we're really committed to reducing smoking, hopefully it's not a very sustainable long-term source of funding. We want to see fewer Hoosiers smoking and using other tobacco products. So I think at some point we have to start thinking in terms of investment. And again, I would come back to the $3 billion figure that Monique cited earlier. It seems to me there's some low-hanging fruit here. If we could start investing, if we could put the $35 million into prevention and cessation, and we could save several hundred million dollars a year beginning within a few years, it seems to me that money would be available for priorities such as roads. So, maybe there's a priority order here that we're not paying enough attention to.
Gotten a question from a listener named Tyler via Facebook, and if you want to reach us on Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Tyler writes, asks, and I'm going to synthesize, says, do you find it morally justifiable to tax, in effect, a minority that, smokers or alcohol drinkers or whatever for their choices? I'll start with you, Representative Clear.
Well, it's a little bit of a delicate topic because it's not just a minority in the sense that smokers or people who drink alcohol make up a minority segment of the population, certainly in the case of smoking. But we know that smoking is increasingly concentrated among low-income and minority populations.
And we have a couple of questions about that.
Yeah, too. So I don't want to take too much time, but I think that has to be part of this discussion too, and recognizing that smoking is concentrated there, it seems even more important that we should put resources, that we should target resources to help those populations stop smoking.
So, Monique, where is this right now? I mean, it sounds like we've got one version in which the cigarette tax is included and another in which it is not, and the governor said he would approve. He prefers the one in which it is not. We've only got about 30 seconds left, but where do we go from here?
We keep fighting. We don't stop. That's what our aim is to get people out there to really voice your opinion about why it's important to increase the cigarette tax. And just real quick, I mean, think to David. He just made a key point. The reason why he quit was because of the tax, and that the tobacco industry spend $285 million a year to target individuals to get them addicted to this project, to this product. And that's why we're trying to combat that by increasing the cigarette tax. And that's why it's so important.
That concludes what is going to be the first half of our discussion about a couple of hot legislative issues. My thanks to my guests, Monique French of the American Lung Association and Representative Ed Clear, who's a Republican from New Albany. When we come back, we're going to be talking about solar power and the battle there. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're continuing our conversation about legislative hot topics here on No Limits. The first part of the hour was focused on the cigarette tax. This is going to be talking about solar power. My guests are Jesse Carbonda of the Hoosier Environmental Council and Mark Mazel of the Indiana Energy Association. And I can already tell phone banks have lit up. I've got emails and all of that. So I'm going to start this by saying that I'm going to ask listeners who participate in the conversation, guests, let's try to be as concise as we can to give as many people the opportunity to take part in the discussion as we can. So, Jesse, real quickly, why don't you frame what the issue has been before the legislature?
Well, solar energy is one of the most promising economic sectors in this country. It's going 12 times faster than the private sector nationally, and we don't want to see the opportunity undermined, which is what we feel would happen if SB 309, an anti-rooftop solar bill, were to pass. This bill would add at least five different roadblocks that would significantly discourage people, homeowners, businesses, congregations, and schools from investing in solar, and that in turn will have a devastating effect, we believe, on companies that are in the business of customer-owned generation.
And, Mark, I'm going to ask you to speak real quickly to what some of the make a case in effect for what the bill might do.
So the bill certainly allows for and encourages the ongoing development of renewable resources, the smaller ones included. Rooftop solar is the most common one that I hear about. But at the same time, it sets in place a process that addresses the subsidies that are paid by customers who do not have rooftop solar, as an example, to help them at some point in the future while, again, encouraging it in the near term. Certainly, there's the job growth opportunities are tremendous. At the same time, we see a lot of potential development in areas such as storage, battery technologies, and those need to be encouraged also.
Given the influx of questions we've got, I'm going to throw my prepared question list aside and go straight to listeners' questions.
Perfect.
This comes from a listener named Joe via email, and if you want to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Joe writes, John, I serve as the director of a local nonprofit, Englewood Community Development Corporation, which has completed several solar projects that serve low-income residents and children. I've also watched local companies like Jefferson Electric add a dozen or more new electricians and solar installers over the last few years to keep up with market demand. It's a shame to crush this momentum with a bill that appears to be so anti-competition and anti-consumer. My question is this. What's the rush to pass this bill? It seems very hurried, and there are a lot of organizations like my own who are lined up against it. Schools, farmers, churches, mayors, small business people. Why don't we take a year or two to look at the evidence from both sides? The bill's proponents haven't proven their case, and there's no rush to decide this issue today when none of the utilities is near the 1% threshold. Mark, I'll throw that one to you first.
So one of the things that one should think about in this whole situation is the very advantaged situation in which Indiana finds itself, the advantage being that we are not near that 1% cap. And as a matter of fact, the legislation acknowledges that this is important and raises it to 1.5%. But it gives us the ability to also say, if you have already installed solar on your home or your business, we don't need to go back and change the economics or the deal that you got when you installed that, because we can afford to work with the arrangement that was made for you and address the subsidies at a future date rather than having to worry about it right now. A date, I might add, that is tied to when President Obama agreed to eliminate the federal tax credits.
Jesse.
Some real quick points. One is that the net metering policy that we have in place does not expire until 2020. So emphatically, there's no need to rush this bill. Secondly, the heart of the bill, which is a drastic devaluation in what we credit customer-owned generators for the value that they provide to the grid, is absolutely arbitrary, and that's been conceded on three separate occasions by the author of the bill. So the heart of the bill is arbitrary, and it ought to be done through a reasoned process through the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission. So there ought to be a study that's done by the IURC, and then for us to revisit what amounts to a radical change in policy. Keep in mind that there are only less than 950 homes out of 2.5 million homes that have solar. So the notion that this could possibly be a subsidy on the grid is absolutely not credible.
We are talking about solar power and net metering here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Kenny has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Kenny, welcome to the
program. Hi, Don and Jesse, and I just wanted to weigh in on this. I'm in the business of solar. And I noticed that the first sentence that comes out of the proponents of this bill is always the word subsidy, because that's kind of a high button word. But it's frankly it's quite the opposite. You know, it's not solar users against the rest of the grid. It's not true. In fact, solar people are using just the average sunlight throughout Indiana is 4.5 hours a day. And so for that other 19 and a half hours, solar users are also paying the standard rates that everybody else is paying to their local utility. There's no way to get any more sun than that in Indiana on an annual basis. And the second issue, not least important, is that solar users are frankly investing in their local grids. It's what they're doing. They're putting every panel, every kilowatt hour that they put into the grid is an investment on their part. Nobody is subsidizing that at all. And the grid, the utilities get to resell that power at whatever rates they want throughout the year. And so solar people are certainly paying their own way. And really what this issue is all about, as far as I can see, is solar is represents the democratization of energy in this, for the first time in 100 years since the advent of fossil fuels. You know, we've seen the concentration of wealth over the past 100 years. You see Saudi princes, you know, driving gold-plated cars and all sorts of nonsense throughout the energy industry internationally. And so solar comes along, and now energy and the resources that it produces are now democratized.
Kenny, I want to jump in and let our panelists respond, because I've got a lot of other people stacked up, and I want to give as many people a chance as possible.
Sure.
Just thank you very much for the call, though. Jesse, I'm going to give you first crack at this one.
Sure. Well, I mean, I would just reinforce that the notion of a subsidy has been debunked. In Wisconsin, there was a Public Utility Commission deliberation. And that in which a utility had petitioned to repeal net metering there, and the commission did a study, and they concluded that this so-called subsidy would amounted to less than a penny per month, and so that petition was dismissed. Lawrence Berkeley National Lab has done a study, and it's shown that the impact is less than 1 cent per kilowatt hour. And then, of course, Brookings Institution has done a pretty comprehensive analysis, which has shown eight of 11 studies show that not only are the benefits of solar to the grid exceeding the costs, but that they're actually higher than the retail rate. So, again, the notion of the subsidy has been debunked.
Mark.
So let me actually agree with Jesse on one point, and the point is this. To the extent that there are relatively few net metering customers and quite a significant utility base, the amount that utility base is paying is small. Again, it takes us back to Indiana's advantage that now is the time to address it before we have to go back and harm people who have already installed solar. But I also have to tell you, I struggle with the notion that any time that any entity, any company is asked to pay 11 cents for something that it would otherwise buy 3.5 cents to purchase, I struggle with the notion that there can't be a subsidy. By definition, that's a subsidy. You're paying 11 cents for something you'd buy for 3.5.
If I could, John, briefly respond to that. I mean, this has been brought up many times before, but the problem is there are not an apples-to-apples comparison between the wholesale rate and distributed generation. Distributed generation helps to reduce peak demand on the grid. It helps to achieve voltage control. It helps to achieve grid security. Those are attributes of distributed generation that wholesale power does not have, and those make it distinct and more valuable.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named George, and again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. George writes, Must one sell back the energy one captures? Could one be greedy with their energy and disconnect entirely? Many thanks, George. Mark, I'm going to start with you.
The answer is whether you disconnect from the grid or not, yes, you can keep the energy that you use, and you receive the full value of that energy. So if you generate it and you use it, you can keep as much of that as you want. What we're really talking about is anything that you send out to the grid at this point in time. And there is no change under this legislation. If you use it, you can. Can you disconnect from the grid is a much more difficult question. An earlier caller said that 19 and a half hours out of the day, you would not be generating electricity because the sun just doesn't, again, on average, doesn't shine that much. And that's the challenge with disconnecting from the grid.
Jesse, thoughts?
Well, just briefly, that's the perverse consequence of this legislation, that this legislation is ultimately trying to undermine a competitor to the investor-owned utilities, which is customer-owned generation. And the paradoxical effect of this, or the ironic effect of this, is it may compel people to leave the system altogether.
Which, said differently, would encourage them to invest in technology battery storage. And I might add, incidentally, that utilities, one of the opponents to this bill, will indicate that we need approximately 3 million kilowatts of generation in the future because of coal plant retirements and those kinds of things. The average solar system is somewhere in the 4, maybe 6 kilowatt range. There is a lot of room for solar rooftop in this state.
We've gotten a question from a listener via Twitter, and you can find us on Twitter at WFYI. This comes from Kelly, who asks, does the solar legislation come from ALEC? Jesse, I'll give you first crack.
I don't think it is. It has come from the American Legislative Exchange Council, but it certainly is supporting corporate control of our energy. And, you know, the debate in the public has been very focused on one element of the bill, which is about the dramatic devaluation of the credit that we give to people who generate customer-owned electricity. But what also is at play is that this would potentially impose fixed fees on people who install solar above and beyond the fixed fees that they already pay, potentially. It forbids virtual net metering. It forbids third-party ownership. And it achieves what we would call an expansion penalty. That is to say that if someone were to expand their grid, their system in 2023, they would not be credited at the same level if they install their system now. So those are an array of different ways in which this bill is intended to severely harm customer-owned generation.
Mark.
And of course, I have to keep coming back. People may not like to hear the reality of this, but the reality is all of the things Jesse just listed, in effect, shift the cost from those who have installed a system to those who do not have it. And to the extent that you're using and relying on the grid, you should pay your fair share of that cost and not shift it to someone else. Again, 19 and a half hours of the day, you don't generate electricity. I understand that's an average. It'll vary from day to day. But the point is, you do need to use the electric utilities grid.
Well, I would I would just say, John, that, you know, we have to create public policy from a basis of knowledge. And the facts are that 8 of 11 studies by Brookings Institution, which is an institute I would think that Mark and others would have great regard for, conclude that the benefits of solar to the grid exceed the costs and furthermore exceed it by the retail level. So again, we push back on the notion of this being a subsidy.
And of course, MIT has indicated that we need to remove the net metering subsidy that's in place at the moment because of all of the various negative consequences of it.
We are talking about solar power and net metering here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Chris has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, John. Thanks. So, yeah, I have a solar installation company up in Kokomo, and I wanted to share an observation about jobs growth. I know that's one of the governor's big pillars of his platform this year. Ivy Tech in Lafayette offers an outstanding energy program, and I work closely with them. I'm on their advisory board. They have technical certificates in renewable energy, both from the wind and solar standpoint. And in my own experience just for the last few years, several of the students that I employ part-time with eventual hopes of having them, you know, feed into my company as I grow and, to develop or obtain full-time jobs in their chosen field and therefore stay in the state, prevent a brain drain. for one, they're being advised by their faculty with a lot of justification that, A, solar is not yet a mature enough market for them to rely on many jobs in Indiana. And as a result, many of those guys, some that I actually employed part-time for summer work, have already left the state for Colorado, Washington State, and points west. And so I think that slowing down, we talked about ending subsidies, and that the topic on whether it is a subsidy, we could go forever. But the bottom line is when someone says we're going to end net metering because the industry is mature enough, I strongly disagree with that assessment, and there are others as well. And we will continue to lose well-educated young people from our jobs market if we don't continue to support growth of future industries.
Chris, I'm going to give Mark a chance to respond. I want to hear Jesse's thoughts after that as well. Mark, thank you very much for the call, Chris.
Chris, first of all, let me thank you for your willingness to engage with an organization like Ivy Tech to assure that there's a good alignment between what employers need and then what the students are actually learning. I think that's very commendable that you're willing to give of your time on the advisory council. I think that we also have to acknowledge that Indiana is a great state, but it does not have mountains. It does not have oceans. And we're simply not going to be able to keep here in our state those individuals that might be attracted for whatever reason to an area that's, again, for example, Colorado with mountains. In our particular state, we have seen tremendous growth in these areas. And the industry is maturing in the sense that the costs continue to come down dramatically. The costs for customers by solar installers themselves are indicated at being half of what they were 5 or 6 years ago. And as that continues to develop, employment opportunities will be there. In addition, we are focused at this point on smaller rooftop units. I would remind all of the listeners that the bill supports also the large-scale solar installations. For example, something like you might see at the Indianapolis Airport, the Motor Speedway here in town, and something that can be truly advantageous for our customers and for the community.
Jesse.
Well, one of the reasons why this bill drew bipartisan opposition in both the House and the Senate, including four members of the Republican leadership in the Indiana House of Representatives, was because of the detrimental impact this would have on small businesses like yours, Chris. And just for everyone's knowledge, there are 260,000 jobs in the United States in solar compared to 96,000 in coal. And that's a tremendous economic opportunity. And in a state that puts economic development, certainly Governor Holcomb puts economic development at the top of his agenda, this bill undermines that principle of promoting economic opportunity in our state.
Gotten an email question from more of a comment from a listener named Wyatt. Again, if you want to join the conversation by email, please send your thoughts to nolimits@wfyi.org. Wyatt writes, there is much concern about religious freedom in Indiana these days. Speaking as a pastor of a congregation with rooftop solar, I believe Senate Bill 309 is very much about religious freedom. It is designed by the utilities and their allies to prevent Hoosiers from generating energy from the sun. This includes religious institutions and congregations who wish to honor God's gift of the earth and are called to care for it. Solar generation protects not only our air, water, and climate, but also more of our church budget for mission. Senate Bill 309 is an anti-freedom bill favoring a monopoly bent on controlling the sun. I think, in fairness, I've got to give Mark the chance to respond to that.
Well, again, I would suggest to you that to the extent that a customer feels that it's important in terms of the environment, in terms of their religious background, that these are important things to do, this bill allows you to do it. There is nothing in this bill that prevents that. Quite the opposite. It encourages it by putting in place long-term grandfathering, putting in place a long-term, there's no end to it, subsidy above and beyond the cost of wholesale power. And that's an acknowledgement of the value and the importance of solar. Having said that, it also recognizes that any time you shift costs from one group to another, whether it's churches or people in their individual homes, there needs to be some very thoughtful consideration of how and why we should continue that and whether it makes any sense. I suspect that if we were talking with the gentleman that sent the question in, we could also ask the question of what's your concern for the poor. And once again, that's a subsidy that we're shifting, because typically people that can afford to install solar tend to be higher income. Not a universal guarantee, but they tend to be. And, of course, that shift then goes to lower income people. There's a good study out of California that points that out.
Jesse.
Well, first of all, there's been no study done in the Indiana context regarding the notion of a subsidy. So, when again, we've been arguing, we've been requesting that the commission step in and do a study. We think that's in the interest of good public policymaking. But this bill emphatically would discourage churches and other places of worship from investing in renewable energy. And like I said, it's not just because of this dramatic reduction in the credit that customer-owned generators, solar generators, would get for the electricity they put on the grid, but it could potentially impose a new fixed fee. It would forbid third-party ownership. It would forbid virtual net metering, which are very important mechanisms that we've seen in other states, that is to say third-party ownership and virtual net metering, to make solar energy more affordable to congregations, to small businesses, to schools. So this bill emphatically reduces the ability for people to plug into the grid in an affordable way.
We are talking about solar power here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener to Deanna has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Deanna, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to say I worked very hard volunteering with the Hoosier Environmental Group to talk to people about and make sure they spoke up to their representatives. And I sincerely felt like we were completely, just sidewinded by our own representatives, because this bill is so clearly pro-power company, pro-power company profit. It's cutting and killing a green initiative in our state to get us free from the coal and oil and the fracking that is causing such damage. When we put solar panels on our own homes, and my husband and I are working very hard to get enough money to save up the money to do just that. So this bill says, oh, wow, if you don't get it done by this December, and if you don't get it done by this date, the amount of money that you'll be able to save yourself by contributing to a green power will be drastically reduced, continuously reduced. And I just don't understand a representative community. I understand a power company that wants it. I don't understand a representative community of our state that will vote against more renewable, more green options when we have generations of children coming behind us, and Trump wants to be pro-coal and pro-oil. And it's spilling everywhere. When I have solar power on my roof, I have the ability to vote for something clean no matter what my president wants to support. I have the vote. I have an ability to vote. But if they take away my ability to make financial improvements in my life, I can't even recover the costs. So it kills
Deanna,
green energy.
I'm gonna cut in because we are starting to get a little bit tight on time, and I want to give these folks a chance to respond. Jesse, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I think one important observation to raise is just the array of opposition to this bill. I've been working on Indiana utility issues for more than a decade, and I have never seen the outpouring of opposition that we have seen in the House Utilities Committee and the Senate Utilities Committee. Testimony that ought to have been an hour, hour and a half, being 6 hours long, and the opposition being overwhelming. Both in terms of the presence in the committees and in terms of the people calling it. I had Republican legislative aides telling me we received dozens and dozens of calls in opposition to the bill and zero calls in support of the bill. So I think as Governor Holcomb wrestles with what to do with regards to this bill, we would like him to listen to the public will, in which across the political spectrum, from conservatives to libertarians to those on the other side of the spectrum, are all opposed to this bill. He needs to listen to the public will.
Mark.
So the bill certainly does not in any way, shape, or form limit someone's ability to install a system. It simply says if you're trying to install a system and count on a payback, don't count on other people contributing to your payback. You build the system to serve your needs. To the extent you send power to the utility, there is a price established that you pay for it. It is not something, though, that you should count on people subsidizing your investment. I would also suggest that the bill does not in any way, shape, or form, agreeing with Jesse, address things like virtual net metering. The reason this bill addresses net metering metering is because it's an existing policy. Virtual net metering is not allowed today, and the bill simply doesn't address that topic. Each of the other issues that Jesse has raised are brand new to the energy dialogue and have not been vetted in any way, shape, or form, where net metering has been around for an extended period of time, something like 12 years.
We've gotten several emails and messages that deal with this theme. I'm going to choose one that's representative from a listener named Maureen. Maureen writes, I am a newly awakened citizen who attended the very first hearing of the solar bill and was stunned by two important problems. The hearing had been moved to the full Senate chamber to accommodate the crowd, but unused plush leather seats had been reserved by lobbyists. Two people fainted in the standing crowd, but lobbyists sat up front. The other problem, the bigger one, is that the bill sponsor takes excessive donations from Duke Energy. There's no way he can be impartial given the trough he is feeding from. When I later looked up legislative rules, imagine my surprise when reading that conflicts of interest are prohibited. Shouldn't our legislature be sued or to either drop that ignored rule or quit accepting clearly quid pro quo payments? That was Maureen. Jesse, I'm going to give you the first word and Mark the last.
Well, our review of the campaign finance data shows that the utility sector, the investor-owned utilities, may well be the number one contributor of campaign contributions in the Indiana General Assembly. So we are deeply, deeply concerned about the undue influence of utilities on policymaking.
Mark.
I would suggest on the other side that while campaign contributions are important and allow candidates to move their message out, I did not see in this scenario, in the arenas I work in, I did not see that having an undue influence. I will suggest to you that this bill is a difficult bill for the utility industry because the benefits of the bill were significantly reduced as it moved through the legislative process from our viewpoint. To the extent anyone felt there was undue influence, I wouldn't be able to make that statement, and I can guarantee you that this is a bill that our industry finds challenging.
We've got just a little bit of time, so I'm going to ask some very quick, short questions here. First, when we talk about this subsidy, and I know there's a debate about whether it is, in fact, a subsidy. I'm just using that term to move the discussion along. How much does it cost? Mark?
It depends on how you look at it. Each individual that installs a solar system on their roof is being paid 11 cents when they could be paid 3.5. The utility could buy the power for 3.5. That's a 300% subsidy. But there are only, in taking all net metering customers as opposed to just the residential, there's only about 1,100 customers here in Indiana. If you take the subsidy being paid and divide it across several million electric customers, the amount per electric customer gets small. That's our advantage. Let's use it as an advantage. Let's not give it up by waiting too long.
Jesse.
Well, I think the conversation, the narrative has been unduly focused on this notion of a subsidy when the real way to think about this issue is, are we properly valuing the array of benefits that people who are powered by solar bring to the grid? That's the fundamental question, and net metering has been a sound policy shown in 43 different states.
And right now, as I understand it, we're waiting to see whether the governor is going to sign this thing. It's moved in front of him. I'd like to thank both of you for what has been a very lively conversation and to our listeners for contributing some great questions. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.